From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, growing up in a Tibetan monastery, Sogyal Rinpoche was raised in a monastery by one of Tibet's great spiritual teachers. They fled to India in 1959 after Tibet fell to China. Now Sogyal Rinpoche lives in England and teaches Buddhism to Westerners. Also today, post-Soviet culture. We talk with Russian writer and former dissident Viktor Ерофеев. He hosts a Moscow TV show and has a best-selling novel. And TV critic David Bianculli reflects on yesterday's media coverage of the fiery end of the Branch Davidians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has ordered an investigation into the events leading up to yesterday's fiery end to the siege of the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. At the same time, though, the president accepted responsibility for the operation and expressed support for Attorney General Janet Reno. In Texas, the FBI held a news conference to defend its decision to assault the compound with tanks and tear gas. NPR's John Burnett was there.
They were asked specifically, why did you go in when you did? They said, responded that that the children could have died of either starvation or disease if they'd waited a long, long time, and that Koresh's interpretation of the seven seals, which he was purportedly doing, was a blatant stalling tactic, and they just didn't want to wait any longer. Questioned about the use of tear gas and whether it could have touched off the blaze, they said it was non-flammable and that tear gas was the only non-lethal substance that they had. And in fact, they had hoped that the use of tear gas would distract the cult members from suicide. And of course, in fact, it had the opposite effect.
NPR's John Burnett in Waco. The first of what are expected to be several congressional hearings into the events in Waco will take place next Wednesday, NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee with jurisdiction over the FBI will hear from Attorney General Janet Reno and FBI Director William Sessions. The chairman of the panel, California Democrat Don Edwards, says several other high-ranking Justice Department and FBI officials have also agreed to attend. Edwards says among the questions he wants answered is who is giving the advice officials relied on before deciding to undertake yesterday's ill-fated operation.
We want to know about the expert advice that was given. Which psychiatrists, which psychologists, we'd like to talk to them. There are literally dozens of questions that I'm sure the American people and we certainly believe should be delved into.
Henry Hyde, the ranking Republican on the panel, says it appears officials ran out of patience with David Koresh and says there are questions of competence of those making decisions. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The inmates who've barricaded themselves in a cell block at the Southern Ohio prison had their first meeting today with a lawyer. Prison officials brought in prisoners' rights activist Nikki Schwartz to help end the standoff, which is now in its 10th day. Three inmates talked with Schwartz and the negotiators in a yard outside the cell block where the prisoners are holding five guards hostage. There's been no indication whether the inmates intend to release any more hostages. Stock prices fell sharply today, reacting to declining bond prices and news that housing starts fell substantially more in March than most analysts expected. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 23 points to close at 3,443.5. This is NPR News. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl decided today to contribute more than 1,600 soldiers to the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Somalia. The operation will be the first armed mission for German troops since the end of World War II. Kohl had pledged to provide troops in December, but the actual decision to send them came only after pressure from UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali. That's because the decision to send troops overseas is strongly opposed by the opposition Social Democratic Party. Some people interpret the German Constitution as banning all deployments of German troops outside the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Although people tend to be suspicious of pesticides, only a handful of relatively rare cancers have been linked to pesticide exposure. A report in this week's issue of the Journal of the National Cancer Institute suggests, but does not prove, that the pesticide DDT may increase a woman's risk of breast cancer. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Researchers from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City studied 58 women with breast cancer and 171 women who were cancer-free. They found that women exposed to the highest levels of DDT were the most likely to develop breast cancer. The researchers say the finding may help explain the increasing rate of breast cancer in the United States. But the study was too small to reach any definitive conclusion. And American women needn't shun fruits and vegetables because they fear DDT. The chemical has been banned in this country for 20 years. Several large studies have proven that a high intake of fruits and vegetables lowers a woman's risk of several common cancers, including breast cancer. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The Senate has killed a $6 billion Republican substitute to President Clinton's jobs bill. The measure was rejected on a vote of 53-45. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is part of the last generation of Buddhists to grow up in a Tibetan monastery. He followed the Dalai Lama to India in 1959, the year Tibet fell to China. After the Chinese invaded Tibet, they destroyed over 6,000 monasteries. Many monks who remained in Tibet were imprisoned. Tens of thousands of Tibetans were sent to labor camps. My guest, Sogyal Rinpoche, remembers some of Tibet's vanished culture. He's lived in England for over 20 years. His mission is to translate Tibetan Buddhism for Westerners. His new book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, is his attempt to make the concepts of the Tibetan Book of the Dead more accessible to Westerners. By the way, the name Rinpoche means precious one and is a term used for revered spiritual teachers from Tibet. Sogyal Rinpoche was brought to a Tibetan monastery by his parents when he was 6 months old. I asked him if this was a unique situation.
In my case, it was unique because my family was very closely connected with this particular monastery, and in particular with this very great master called Jamen Khyentse Chuchulodu, who I speak very frequently in the book about him. He was very much really like my spiritual father, and that he in many ways was perhaps the greatest Tibetan master of the century. And because of this unique connection, that as they happened to come to the monastery on that particular occasion, and that then it was discovered that my master actually recognized me on that occasion as being the incarnation of this very great mystic and great master called Tertön Sogyal. In fact, I have the same name as him. In fact, it was very interesting that my master gave me the name Sogyal before even he recognized me as an incarnation of this same master with the same name. And this master was, in fact, he was his own master and was also the master of the previous Dalai Lama. That's this present Dalai Lama is the 14th. The previous Dalai Lama is the 13th. He was a very 13th Dalai Lama, and he was his teacher, and he was a very great master.
What does it mean to be recognized as the incarnation of an earlier spiritual leader?
Well, the thing is, you see, as I think many now quite know, I think well know that in Tibet we had this special tradition of really choosing kind of special children from very young to be trained as teachers, and often they're known as the incarnations. And that is to say, when an enlightened master or an enlightened being dies and he doesn't retire into kind of enlightenment, his really pledge and his really vision and compassion is to really work for the benefit of all beings until all beings are liberated from what is called samsara, that is to say, through the confusion and through ignorance, so that in a sense they come back, they send out their emanation, their blessing. If you were to make a comparison with, in a sense, with Christianity, it's more like receiving the grace that I would see as so. And so they would choose a child in whom their grace or their blessing or their kind of mind is transmitted. And so this child becomes their instrument of their work. And then they, of course, most important is not only the choice of the incarnation, but most important role is the education.
What are some of your early memories of being taught at the monastery?
In my case, you see, I was very fortunate, really, that the master who brought me was perhaps the greatest Tibetan master of the century. And I always remember that kind of the warmth and that kind of the serenity and the peace, the atmosphere that he brought me in. Really, I owe, in some ways, I really owe kind of my own confidence in myself, perhaps also the humor, perhaps to really to this master. And I sometimes believe, you see, when you're born, the environment you're born is like your second womb, and how that environment very much affects your being. So what I remember is of my childhood was not so much the things, the particular things that I've learned, but more thing I remember is the atmosphere, this warm atmosphere of compassion and wisdom that has a really deep effect on my whole being.
Do you remember anything about what daily life in the monastery was like for you?
Oh, yes, it was that I remember. You had to rise up very early in the morning at the kind of crack of dawn. And then I would do my morning prayers, and then I would need to go to my tutor because I was a special child and specially to be brought as a teacher. So I was always assigned to this a very strict tutor who guided my kind of education over 18 hours a day almost. And then so I would go to him and I'd go over and revise this, whatever I've learned. And then when the kind of after a kind of breakfast, which I also have to eat with my tutor, which is not so much fun, then I go over with my tutor over to see my master, to whom I would give the test of each lessons that I've learned. And then he would give the teachings. And then my tutor and I would go over the question that we have and then go and hold a study. So that was the routine. And then there were also, what I really used to enjoy was the days when my master would give very big initiations or like the empowerments and give big teachings. And these teachings were the days when I was free of my studies.
How old were you when China invaded Tibet?
Well, I was about 13 then, around 13 or in my early teens when that happened. In fact, actually the invasion of Tibet took earlier, as you know, in the early 1950s, but the occupation was in 1959.
And then you went to India?
Then we came to India, yes.
How did the spiritual masters who you knew then deal with invasion and bloodshed and all the horrible things that come with that?
Well, of course, with great sadness. But the thing also, what was quite amazing is that they had a very great acceptance in some sense, you see. I remember, for example, myself being quite young, I could cope with changes more easily, but I was amazed with the attitude of some of my parents and many of the elders. They would often say that we are glad that at least we are alive, you know, and then they often used to say, as Buddha taught us, that everything is impermanent. So what is happening to us is this great impermanence. Instead of becoming embittered, in a sense, it really brought them more home to the truth of the teachings. And also something quite extraordinary is because of the compassion teachings that, in a sense, they did not make them embittered, in a sense that really they even took. There's a saying, and a wonderful saying in the teaching says, when the one who from whom you expected the most, you see, like a friend or somebody that you trust and from you expected most, if he or she hurts you in the way that you couldn't possibly imagine, may that person become your best teacher. So in many ways, that even though the Chinese really turned against us, when we least expect it, in some ways the teachings really kind of provided us that the basis of understanding to really not to turn hatred, to not have hatred against our enemy, but instead to look at them as our greatest teacher from a spiritual point of view.
So when you went to India, your family came too?
In my case, this is very fortunate. Most of my family managed to escape along with my master, yes.
When you lived in India, was that the first time you were exposed to different cultures and different religions?
It was up in Sikkim, actually, which is the Himalayan kingdom. And then it was the Himalayan kingdom, up in the near Darjeeling, that area of India, yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sogyal Rinpoche, and he was brought up in a Tibetan monastery and now teaches Buddhism. And he's written a new book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. You decided to go west to study at Trinity College, to study comparative religion at Trinity College at Cambridge University. And I guess I'm interested in hearing what inspired you to study other religions.
I think it became more gradual, actually, you see, because as we kind of, you know, were exposed to this completely new world, not because of a choice, but by circumstances, it fell particularly my mother, who had kind of a very special, she had kind of quite a foresight. I quite admired her with a vision. and that, in fact, I owe very much of my education to her really vision of coming, for example, to the West and having studied English. She felt that really people like young lamas like myself really should learn English and learn the West of the ways of the outside world. And so I went to a Catholic school to learn the ways of the outside world. In a Catholic school to learn English and to have some kind of a basic Western education. And along with that, I continue my own studies, own Buddhist studies also, because the school is not a whole year round. And then later I went to Delhi University to continue my studies. And then it was kind of almost a natural progression to come to England, because I always felt from as we came out into India, and I always felt that my work would be in the West. You know, I had a kind of an intuitive feeling, and I wanted to always come. And then as I came into contact with the Christian fathers, who were very kind to me, who really also respected my faith very much, and so in some ways I became interested in Christianity, and you know, I felt that I should really learn the way of the outside world, learn other religions. So I came to Cambridge on a visiting scholarship to study comparative religion.
I'm still trying to imagine what it was like for you in Catholic school after growing up in a Buddhist monastery in Tibet.
It was very interesting. In fact, somehow, the principal of my school, you see, he was from Switzerland, from an area called Valais, near Geneva area, you know, in the Sion. And he was a Catholic from a kind of a missionary school called St. Augustine's. And the father was very kind to me. I always used to see, because I was very much practicing during that time, I used to think very much that even the father, who was the principal, my teacher, my school, as being like my own master. In a sense, my education kind of continued, because I always think of this as my teacher.
Were there interesting similarities or conflicts between your Buddhist practices and the Catholic traditions that you were being brought up with?
Of course, there are kind of, you see, at the kind of outset, when you look, forms are very different, and that kind of. But then, as I come to really know the teachings, and as I come to know my own Buddhist teachings more and more, and as I began to understand the Christian teachings more, I began to see increasingly similarities. And also what was wonderful was with these fathers, they were very kind of lenient, you know, was quite an exception, because sometimes missionary schools are quite strict about kind of teaching Christianity. But because of my being kind of a Tibetan Lama, they used to call me Lamala. La is like a respect, Lamala they used to call me. And that, in a sense, they would allow me to have my own shrine in the kind of in the desks. I would make my own shrine. And for example, first I used to go to the church quite easily. I had no problem. I learned all the Christian prayers, you know. I was quite comfortable. I did my own practice in the church. But then later, when I became the school kind of the head also, I became the school head, in a sense that all who are non-Christians needn't necessarily go to school, not go to church, and they could go on have their Buddhist holidays. And I brought some kind of, in some ways, the awareness of other religions in my school a little bit. And also, you see, what was interesting, the fathers actually entrusted me, the school to me. When one of the fathers had to go on to Switzerland on a kind of a long vacation or to meet the family, I think that someone was ill, I was in charge of the school, and I also taught catechism for a while.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sogyal Rinpoche. He's a Tibetan Lama who fled Tibet after the Chinese invasion. He now lives in England. And he's written a new book that is in a way a kind of version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead for Western people. It's called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sogyal Rinpoche, a Buddhist teacher who grew up in a Tibetan monastery. He's written a new book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. You said that you had a feeling that your work would be in the West, and in fact, your work has been in the West. You've been living in England and lecturing and teaching around the world. What role do you think your Buddhist teachings can serve in the lives of Western Christians, Jews, and Western Muslims?
I think perhaps it would really open the eyes to the true spirituality, I think, you see, because I think what is the unique about Buddhism and particularly the Tibetan tradition is not the forms of the religions, but in a sense it has the lineage of really understanding. That is to say, we have, for example, really we are taught from young. For example, what I've learned from my masters, really the meaning of the scriptures, really the deeper meaning, not just the scriptures, but really the meaning behind the meaning, so to speak. So all these wisdom and compassion, really the practices, the methods of realizing the wisdom, as these are kind of taught, not only taught, they're practiced and really experientially transmitted. This is what lineage is. Somehow, in a sense, it really begins to unfold the depth of spirituality. And spirituality becomes really part of life. That's why, for example, Tibet was unique, because the spirituality was really, religion was not just religion on one side, as sometimes often in the West is, you know. The religion is religion and secular life is secular. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And people go to church only on Sundays and immediately go to a pub. Like in England, at least. And so, in a sense, as you see, that religion or like the spirituality is part of everyday life. That, in a sense, this is the essential part of the heart of our kind of our being. So that is, in some ways, I feel that the Buddhism coming to the West, in some ways, in a sense, helped to renew people of the different religions in their own faith.
It's interesting to me that you've studied comparative religions and you've studied Catholicism as well as practicing Buddhism, yet you counsel against getting trapped in the West's shopping mentality toward religion. So tell me what it is that you're trying to caution us against there.
I think it's just sometimes I think, you see, like suppose if you're going on a freeway, you know, to a place, and if you keep changing your mind, which road you're going to be going forth and backward, probably you're going to sometimes get stuck in a traffic jam and also even take much longer to get anywhere you want to go. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, you see, I find that it's important when you really follow us, want to really follow the spiritual path, it's important to follow one path. And like even in Tibet, to follow like a one master. Because by so doing, that you actually come to really know intimately the path, in a sense. Because you see, there's, for example, the language, and there's the way of the kind of transmitting, and these. When you come to know the ways of this thing, because what we're trying to communicate in the spiritual teaching, something sometimes which is beyond the mind, which really through really coming to know the teacher and the student both intimately, we can come to really know these teachings. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so through that, you see, once you begin to really understand, have a good grounding in the teaching and the practice, then one can really follow other teachings. In fact, first you must have a good grounding. Like, for example, myself, because I had a fairly good grounding in the Buddhist teachings and practice, as such, it really gives me the freedom to appreciate and to not to, you know, appreciate other religions, such as Christianity, and really see the commonality point. Whereas, if suppose I was not secure in my own faith and in my own practice, and then perhaps I would be less kind of open or perhaps more suspicious. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think so. Hmm?
And so, as such, I think it's very important to really practice, follow one path, or really to become kind of, to study, to know one path well, and then, because that doesn't mean to say that, you know, you shouldn't be open. You can be open, as my master used to say. He was a very great kind of the leader of the ecumenical movement in Tibet. He used to say one should practice one's own, but be open to all. So once you really have a path, and once you really understand the teaching, like Buddhist teachings well, then you can even study Christianity and other religions and begin to really not get confused. Whereas if you start picking up here and there, and like with a shopping mentality, perhaps you get bits of wisdom, but you do not know how to put them all together.
Tell us why you wanted to focus a book around death.
I think, you see, I've found that in the West, there is such a kind of fear about death. And I realized the fear primarily comes from really not knowing very much about what really death is. Because I think the fear comes from this ignorance. And so I felt that really through information, through teachings, by coming to really know what death is, one begins to realize there's something that we can befriend, you know. That death is not a tragedy to be feared, but can be an opportunity for transformation. And so that's one of the reasons. Another thing is with the coming of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which, as you know, was translated in 1927, even though it was a wonderful teaching, a wonderful scripture somehow, but this is kind of a little bit advanced, or and if it's not really interpreted in the right way, without the full context of the teachings, one would not be able to understand properly. So I had written this book in order to really kind of bring it into context, the Tibetan teachings on life and death. I think I want to emphasize this is not just a book of really dead, but also about life, so as to give really the complete vision of the living and dying, of which the Tibetan Book of the Dead forms an important part. It explains the context, the background, the meaning of the teachings behind the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it gives the key to the understanding of it.
How old were you when your spiritual master died?
I was about 13 that time, you see. And that was really, in a sense, like the whole ground of my existence kind of fell apart.
Were you near him when he died?
Yes, I was near him. In fact, I always used to sleep next to him. But I remember early that morning, the day that he died, I was taken very early from the place. And for 3 days, I did not know that he had passed away. It was kind of kept secret, because sometimes, you see, it's believed that according to the Buddhist tradition, that some of the great masters, when they die, they actually enter into meditation for sometimes 3 days. In my case of my master, as I mentioned in the book about the story of his death, that he actually rested in meditation for 3 days. And it was quite an extraordinary experience. So I didn't come to know about it until about 3 days after.
When you say rested in meditation, you mean meditating in such a way that some might think he's dead even though he's still alive?
It's like this, that you see, the outer, like for example, when you breathe out last, even though the outer breath has ceased, but inner breath is still going on. In such cases of actually practitioners, not only masters, but many practitioners, it's quite a common phenomenon in Tibet. That you see, that you can feel a kind of a warmth at the heart, the whole complexion, even though they are kind of pronounced as clinically dead, but there you can see that really the color of doesn't fade away. They're really, you know, they're just very much like alive. And when they come out of the meditation of the 3 days, then the color goes away, and you know, the head droop. Until that, I'm sometimes even rest in the meditative posture and die in that state.
Did you think that your spiritual master was using his death as a lesson? I don't mean that he was dying to teach you a lesson, but did he, during his death, use that as a lesson for you?
I think so, very much so, really. And I think he taught me so much in his death, and then also even now, I sometimes feel he's always teaching me. In fact, you know, all the great masters that I met after his death, I always felt that it was he was brought to me, bringing to them all.
Could you tell us something about what you think you learned from watching him die?
Well, I think it's, you see, I think first of all that we always, you see, even though it's certain that we're going to die, somehow, since it's uncertain when or how we're going to die, somehow we kind of think it's not going to happen to you, and that we have an unlimited lease on our life. And when the master like him died, then of course me, you know. So it was like to wake up the soul for the naive like me to really the truth of impermanence, and the death is a reality. And so therefore, when that is the case, that at the moment of death, only that thing that would help me was my spiritual practice. So therefore, in a sense, it really helps me to focus on my spiritual practice and really face the truth of myself, which is what facing death is. Facing death is facing the truth of yourself.
Have you ever returned to Tibet since you fled there?
No, not yet, no.
Would you want to, if you could?
I want to, but I think it's also I want the situation and circumstances to change there, in a sense, because I think some ways I sometimes feel that I would probably miss Tibet more when I'm in Tibet.
Because it won't be anything like what you remember?
Yes, true, and it'd be kind of rather really, it's like going back to a place where you had such a wonderful time, but then when you go there, you know, you become even more sad.
I want to thank you very much for talking with
thank
us.
Thank you.
Sogyal Rinpoche is the founder and director of Rigpa, a network of Buddhist centers around the world. His new book is The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with Russian writer and former dissident Viktor Arifayev. His new best-selling novel about a beautiful Russian bisexual could never have been published before Perestroika. But now Arifayev says anything goes in Russian culture. Arifayev's earlier anthology of Soviet dissident writers cost his father his job as a Soviet diplomat. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reflects on the media frenzy over the tragedy in Waco yesterday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a day of appearing to distance himself from events in Waco, Texas, President Clinton made a public statement today accepting full responsibility. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton told reporters today that he, not Attorney General Janet Reno, was the one ultimately responsible to the American people for the decision to use tear gas against the Branch Davidian cult in Waco, Texas.
I was informed of the plan to end the siege. I discussed it with Attorney General Reno. I asked the questions I thought it was appropriate for me to ask. I then told her to do what she thought was right, and I take full responsibility for the implementation of the decision.
Yesterday, the White House had stressed Reno's role. The president's spokesman, George Stephanopoulos, had said the attorney general laid out the argument and the president had no objection. Today, President Clinton described his role more fully. He praised Reno for her work and promised a thorough investigation of the incident to determine, among other things, whether anything could have been done differently. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Waco, Texas, FBI officials said today that some members of the Branch Davidian cult might have lived if they had gone to an underground chamber when fire destroyed the cult's compound yesterday. Officials say that cult members started the fire and some group members may have been killed before the blaze began. Yesterday, a 51-day standoff ended with the apparent deaths of more than 80 cult members. At least 9 cult members escaped. But officials don't know the exact death count until underground passages are searched. In eastern Bosnia, a fragile ceasefire held for a third day today, with UN troops working to disarm Muslim fighters in the region and make the area safe. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Tuzla.
A company of about 140 Canadian soldiers in Srebrenica has until tomorrow morning to disarm the Bosnian Army soldiers in the town under the terms of a ceasefire agreement negotiated last weekend by the commanders of the Bosnian Army and the Bosnian Serb forces. The Serb side, which has kept Srebrenica under siege for a full year, agreed to hold its fire pending the disarmament of the Muslim fighters defending the town. So far, however, the Canadians have collected only a few weapons. The Muslim side says the disarmament agreement applies only to the center of the town. Fighters on the front lines around the town have not given up their weapons and evidently have no intention of doing so. UN officials have asked the Serb side for a 3-day extension of the disarmament deadline. They are worried the Serbs might resume their shelling of Srebrenica if the Muslims there are not totally disarmed. I'm Tom Jelton in Tuzla.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 23 points to close at 3,443.49 on volume of 317 million shares. This is NPR News. For the first time in a week of flying over Bosnia, NATO airplanes have seen an offending aircraft in the no-fly zone. Officials say that 2 U.S. Air Force jets spotted a helicopter on the ground with its blades still rotating after it had been located in the air by radar. President Clinton met today with his top national security advisors to consider new approaches and efforts to stop the fighting in Bosnia. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
As the administration reviews its options in Bosnia, the use of force is being considered very seriously. There are several possibilities. For example, the U.S. could lobby for an end to the U.N. arms embargo against former Yugoslavia so the Muslim-led government of Bosnia could buy more weapons for self-defense. Or the U.S. could press for Allied airstrikes against Serbian positions. Britain and France currently oppose these options, but administration officials say the Allies could change their views if the fighting continues. In addition to military options, new diplomatic efforts to end the war are also being considered by the administration. Meanwhile, in Senate hearings today, some key Democrats criticized their president's policy toward Bosnia as ineffective. "We've not done a damn thing," said Senator Joseph Biden. Paul Simon said, "We're not responding today as we should." This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Vice President Al Gore, speaking today in Warsaw, said the United States will not abandon Eastern Europe as Washington moves to aid Russia. Speaking to the Polish parliament, Gore said that Serbia and Poland stand at opposite ends of a moral world, and he contrasted Eastern Europe's springtime of liberty with the current violence in Bosnia. Gore's two-day visit to Poland is the first between the new administration and the Polish government. Gore brought no promises of new aid, but said the U.S. will be with Poland each step of the way, and he called Poland a model for other new democracies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is one of the Russian writers who was punished for his work by the communists and is now thriving in the new Russian freedom. Viktor Erofeyev's work was banned after he edited a 1979 anthology of works by dissident writers. Now he's the author of a best-selling novel that breaks political and sexual taboos from the communist era. His book, Russian Beauty, is about a bisexual woman and the affair she has with diplomats, dissidents, journalists, and KGB officers. Viktor Erofeyev also hosts a TV show in Russia on the arts, literature, and post-Soviet culture. He says Soviet culture is dead.
You know, the Soviet culture ended before the end of the Soviet Union, just because all structures died with the perestroika era. And literature, arts, the whole culture just stopped to be Soviet because nobody wanted them to be ideological. That's why we have to start a new culture, post-Soviet, post-communist culture. And in Moscow, I have a TV show and where I try to help this new culture to emerge.
What do you do on your TV show?
Well, I invite people for talk show. We shoot new galleries. We speak with many people about what they want to have from the culture. We show new bookstores. We talk to booksellers. So many things I'm doing there.
How much freedom do you have on your TV show? Can you say anything? Can you criticize the government?
We are completely free. You know, I think that even my thought is that we are more free than in the West, because you know, when you have a new freedom, completely just born freedom, then you could allow yourself to do everything you want. And so there is no censorship, there is no control. We can even use dirty words, you know, what's a little bit maybe strange for Americans. And we could also show rather sexual things in my show, and also it's not forbidden. So no political taboos, no social taboos, no sexual taboos, no forbidden themes. Everything is possible. It's really something very special for us, because only 2-3 years ago we were slaves, you know.
What kind of sexual things have you shown on your program?
Oh, we could speak about lesbian clubs, with homosexual clubs, which are now appear in Moscow. We could speak about any problem, you know, concerning sex. And sex and pornography in culture, also a new theme for us, because before it was completely forbidden. The last two themes were forbidden in the former Soviet Union were Lenin and sex, and Lenin sex and the sex or a sexual life of Lenin too. Yeah.
So do you have large ratings for your TV show? Do a lot of people watch it?
Yeah, I think 100 million people.
Whoa.
Like that. Yeah, wow. Yeah, yeah. It's all national Russian TV. It's a second program which people could see in every town, every city of all around Russia.
So do people think of your show as being intellectual or sleazy because there's sexual discussion on it?
The both, I think. But but still, you know, the letters, we got many letters. They want me to be intellectual in a way that they want to think with me, to think about new culture. They don't want me to just to go after them, but not to follow them, not to have some special messages, but they want me to be a little bit smarter than they are. You know, this is also very typical for Russia, that in TV we don't like people who follow, you know, middle-class interests. We prefer people who could say something unusual and sometimes even irritating, you know. So it's like this in Russia.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Russian writer Viktor Ерофеев, and his novel Russian Beauty has just been published in the States. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Russian writer Viktor Ерофеев, author of the novel Russian Beauty. I want to ask you a little bit about your own background as a writer. I know in 1979 you edited a collection of pieces by dissident writers.
Right.
And you published this in an edition of 12.
Yeah.
It was confiscated by the KGB. What was your punishment?
Oh, the punishment was very strict. You know, I decided to organize this collection just to protest about completely absurd censorship in the Soviet Union. So I invited 23 Russian writers, as well as John Updike, who was our American guest, to this collection, and so we publish it illegally, undergroundly, just to show that there are a lot of writers, older and younger, vanguardist and classical, more conservative writers, who couldn't be published in the Soviet Union because of aesthetical, because of political reasons. And so the authorities took our initiative very, very aggressively. They thought that this is the beginning of new Prague Spring of the 68. And so they took all measures against us. I was kicked out from the Writers Union. It meant that I started to be an ex-Soviet writer, ex-writer. And I thought at that time that it will continue till the end of my life. And it would continue if Gorbachev didn't come to power. Then they kicked me. I lost my job as a researcher in the Institute of World Literature. So I've lost all my jobs in Russia. But not only this, my own father also lost his job. He was ambassador to Vienna, Austria at that time. So he had to return to Moscow, and he lost his job as a diplomat.
Were you told by the KGB that if you didn't renounce your own collection, that your father would lose his job? Were you given that opportunity to denounce your own work?
Yes. They gave me such a nice opportunity to denounce my own work. And when my father returned to Moscow, he had to go to the Central Committee of Communist Party and to KGB every day. They told him, you have to press on your son, and so he so-called worked with me for 40 days, receiving his ambassador's salary in dollars, just talking to me, and then he understood, and it was a very big relief for me that the pressure and the hate for me from KGB and from the party is so big that even if I write a letter, he'll never be sent to Vienna again just because I'm somebody whom they don't want to have in Soviet literature. And so one day he told me one very important thing. He said, "Listen, Victor, I think you shouldn't write a letter." I said, "Why?" Because he said, "You know, I am already a dead man, politically dead man in our family. But if you write the letter, you'll be the second dead man in our family."
So what kind of work did your father do after you decided to not denounce your work?
Oh, you know, it was a grotesque job because after I said that I won't write the letter, so he stayed in Moscow and doing nothing. So I decided to write another letter, but not a letter of apologies, but a letter of blackmail, if we want to Brezhnev. When I said that my father is my father and I am, and if you want to punish me, punish me, not my father. And in this letter I said that if my father will not have job in Moscow as a diplomat, that I don't know what I'll do with myself. So I hinted that maybe I'll commit a suicide. And I managed to send this letter to Brezhnev because, you know, my family was a privileged family and we still had good contacts with the top people. And so Brezhnev read this letter, but there was a big pause during 2 weeks, and at that time I thought, so I have to hang myself. Well, I didn't know what to do with myself, and it was not a very nice time. But then he called Gromyko and said, "Okay, Mr. Rafiev could work as Minister of Foreign Affairs just like a diplomat." So my father was invited to work, but when he came, he got his study there, his office, he got his secretary, but they never put just a paper on his table. So he had to read Pravda, our official newspaper, for 3 or 4 years, Pravda and other official newspapers, doing completely nothing, receiving good salary, pretending working, but doing nothing. It was a really very special. It was a very special thing. It was big Soviet grotesque.
Now, your father had been Stalin's French interpreter and also the personal assistant to Stalin's foreign minister, Molotov. What do you think it was like for your father to work for Stalin?
You know, my Stalin my father loved Stalin a lot because in their relationship, their official relationship, Stalin was always very, very, very kind to him, you know, and he always talked to him about his family, and you know, about his background, about his studies in the Leningrad University. So for many years, even after Khrushchev destalinization of Russia, my father repeated that, you know, of course, Stalin is a killer, a murderer, but you know, but he is very human, very, very, very human. Now he doesn't think so anymore, but this tradition of love for Stalin in my family was very strong and very bizarre. And I must tell you that I had a very happy Stalinist childhood because of the fact that my father was a Stalin interpreter. We had big limousines, good country houses, fantastic apartment, a black caviar every morning I had, and so on and so on. It was very strange, bizarre childhood after the war in Russia, in Moscow, very gray, gloomy Moscow, and we were exceptional.
It sounds like you've decided to see the absurd aspects of this.
Yeah. Yeah, it was completely absurd, you know, this situation. Now I understand it perfectly, because people around us were very, very poor at that time, really poor, and we with these black limousines and black caviar, we look like, you know, like completely out of that world.
Let me ask you, if after the KGB confiscated your journal, your magazine, if your father had said, please apologize because I want to keep my job, would you have done it?
It was a really awful situation for me, because as I told you, my father did a lot for me. You know, because of him, I spent 3 years in Paris as a child. Then I could travel in Africa, in Europe, everywhere I wanted to travel. I had dollars. I had opportunity to see the world, you know. And then politically I killed my father. So, you know, I'll tell you one thing. My father called me from Vienna to tell that they recalled him from Vienna. In one night, in the morning, I saw gray hair on my head. You know, just I was only 30. It was just a shock for me. But from the other side, I understood that I'll never write the letter of apologize, just because it will kill me forever. And so the situation was just awful. And I repeat what I said. I'm very grateful to my father that he told me himself, don't do it.
Are you confident that Russia will keep heading toward democracy as opposed to either back to communism or to some kind of authoritarian rule that would still make it hard for writers like you to have the freedom that you want, not to mention the other freedoms that you want?
Right. You know, I'm sure that we don't have, fortunately, we don't have this way back to communism. With communism, it's finished. With authoritarian regime, it's more complicated. We have many powerful forces in former Soviet Union which want less democratic, more totalitarian or authoritarian regime. But still, I am in this way, I'm very optimistical.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Viktor Ерофеев's novel Russian Beauty is published in the States by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Waco today?
Well, we'll have the news from Waco, of course, but also talk with a forensics expert on what the search of the site of those deaths is likely to tell us, what questions it might answer about what happened yesterday. Also, a talk with Jim Reston Jr., who studied and wrote a book about the Jonestown deaths and what he thought of the handling of the situation in Waco. We'll also be hearing from a UN officer about the fighting in Bosnia between Croats and Muslims. The officer says both are at fault in the fighting in a town called Vitez. And we'll hear about a program to stop the renting of pandas by zoos from China.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The media had been waiting 51 days for the showdown in Waco, Texas, to reach some sort of conclusion. When it did yesterday, TV critic David Biaculli watched the event unfold on 6 TV sets at once. He reached some conclusions of his own.
First of all, it's not surprising, even with 2 months for everyone to prepare, that only CNN was there from the start. It had been covering the story all morning. And ironically, CNN was conducting a phone interview with Bonnie Haldeman, David Koresh's mother, as the smoke and fire began.
According to what your son has told FBI officials and negotiators, he was indeed wounded in the side and in the hand during the original raid. What kind of condition do you believe he's in now? Have they given you any additional information?
I haven't had any information. I have no idea. All I've gotten is what I hear on the radio and in the papers.
As you can see on your screen, there is a great deal of smoke coming out of the building. Let's go to Mike Capps. We can also see some flames there now. Mike, what can you tell us? What can you see?
For the last Koresh's mother hung up with CNN at that moment, which was completely understandable. What was a lot less understandable, at least to me, was something that wasn't evident until later that night when the syndicated show A Current Affair came on. It turns out that Bonnie Haldeman didn't hang up merely out of grief or the need to be alone as those tragic events unfolded. She did it because a camera crew for A Current Affair was ready to record her phone interview with anchorwoman Maureen O'Boyle, whose conversation with her went something like this. The sound quality of the tape isn't that great. Then again, neither is the interview.
David seemed very sure that he was doing the right thing. As you see this building crumble before our eyes on television, do you think David's mission was the right thing?
I don't know exactly what his mission was.
And you've got some grandchildren in there.
My grandbabies are in there. My 3 grandbabies that I was trying to get. How would you be feeling if it was yours? I want to die. That's what I want to do when I get down to feel. I want to die.
Call me old-fashioned, but when a mother is watching her son burn to death on national TV, I don't really think television has a right to be there. I'm not blaming A Current Affair for setting it up, or O'Boyle for conducting the interview, although such questions as how do you feel couldn't be more rhetorical or reprehensible. What I wonder is, why in the world didn't this poor woman recognize that she had the perfect right to throw everyone out of her house, hang up the phone, and deal with the reality of the situation without letting TV intrude? Is the lure of being on TV so strong that people feel that they cannot or dare not or don't want to say no? There are times, and yesterday was one of them, when the best thing TV can do is point its cameras somewhere else.
David Biaculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, A Life in Baseball, we talk with Joe Morgan, one of the few second basemen to make it to the Hall of Fame. Morgan was part of the lineup, along with Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, and Pete Rose, that made the Cincinnati Reds the big red machine of the 70s. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.